Hi, this is Isaac Arthur. Welcome to the show, and don't forget to check out this month's Nebula exclusive, Giant Space Monsters. To get access and help support the show while hearing every episode early and ad-free, plus hours of bonus content, check out go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur and use my code IsaacArthur.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Science and Futures with Isaac Arthur's monthly live stream Q&A this New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2023. As usual, we are joined by my co-host and wife, Sarah Fowler Arthur, who will be asking questions from the audience as you put them in of me, and I'll try to get my best answer as we can. I think we probably mod free because of the holiday right now, so please try to leave them clear and concise and easy to read things so that they don't get lost in the queue. With that said, let's go ahead and get started with our first question.
Well, thank you for including me on these for the last several years, and I actually wanted to give a shout out first to one of your viewers from Ashtabula County that I ran into in the grocery store over the holiday, and Marius told me that you were the inspiration to becoming an engineer.
That's one of the cool things about doing the show for years like this is that you, when I first got started, people would say, hey, I'm thinking about majoring in physics, should I do that? And now I've got folks who are saying, hey, I don't know if you remember this, but like 8 years back, you convinced me to major in physics, and I just finished up my doctorate, and that is an awesome experience. So thank you for everyone who has been with us for, God, we're on our 10th year now, so it's been a long time, and this is the, we're in 6 years into doing the live stream, but this is our 60th one, and we skipped a few here and there, so thank you, Marius, and thank you, everyone.
Miami's Last Capitalist, thank you very much for your super chat. Miami's Last Capitalist says, I will miss these live streams, but I'm glad I got to know you through them. Neil deGrasse Tyson isn't our personal astrophysicist. You are. Thank you.
Well, he's probably, I would say Neil deGrasse Tyson is probably a better physicist when it comes to astronomy than me, but thank you.
Rob Hawk, thank you for your super chat. From all of the sci-fi novels you have read, which device, machine, or gadget do you find to be the most amazing and imaginative? And best wishes for 2024.
Amazing is a little trickier than imaginative. Well, technically there have been some novels for it, but it's either Stargate from the Stargate SG-1 series and or the movie. That's probably one of my favorite fictional devices because it keeps things kind of grounded to the modern era while still letting you explore space and planets, or at least very many forests in Canada, because that's usually where they film them at, as opposed to this or that old quarry in England or desert area in California. Most of sci-fi takes place in those three spots. Let's see. The most imaginative device.
One of your viewers says, beam me up, Scotty.
Well, yeah, no, I would actually say the transport is probably the exact opposite of that. That's the transport and the replicator from Star Trek are probably the worst devices to include in fiction because you've probably heard the transporters events, so they didn't have to do the shuttle footage all the time back and forth of them flying. And the replicator was meant to be this cute little thing for letting them bring and make eating along. But the problem is those are such plot-rending devices that you don't really want to include things like that in the show if you can avoid or in your sci-fi. The coolest device. Maybe the actual conjoinal drive from Alistair Reynolds' Revelation Space series, or the black, sorry, not the black hole, the neutron star that's almost a black hole, that's one gigantic, huge stellar mass full of quantum matter. Those are both just really cool, real science versions of things that I thought were really awesome.
Rob, I thought for a minute there we had him stumped. Would have been the second time in all of these years, but he pulled it out.
On camera, anyway.
Could utility fog or programmable matter be some kind be used as a force field that could stop bullets? Primaris would like to know.
I know force fields episode, probably like 6 years ago now, we did look at some of those options and say in physics there's not an option for force fields other than the actual existing force fields we have, like gravity or electromagnetism, but you could do something to flex ionized matter away with an electromagnetic field, for instance. But one of your options for a shield is an actual shield. So, for instance, a spaceship might have some thin little panel it carries on with it that it can just shoot out about a kilometer from it, expand rapidly, and let that soak up damage. And it doesn't have to soak that much damage off to deflect stuff. I mean, the vaporized remnant of it's going to, deflect beams or destroy incoming missiles pretty well. But you could have something like utility fog where all it did was just move quickly and get in the way of the bullet. The problem is that for a lot of these things, they're only going to be good against people with lower technology than you. Because if you've got utility fog that can jump and get in the way, then their bullets probably can move faster than utility fog can, or could include utility fog of their own to blow those up and so forth. So, and you could still have some kind of competing cycle of armor versus weaponry, as we often see in history now. But I would say just as a whole, yeah, that is one of the options you have for utility fog. Might be some kind of cape that could soak up bullets for you made out of this stuff. There's a lot of options if you have smart metal. For those who didn't know, utility fog is one of the nicknames for smart metal, which is basically, imagine the smallest piece of matter you can make that was like an intelligent robot, something like the equivalent of a cell for a human body, but probably an order of magnitude smaller, that could move around and connect with each other and talk. So it's just a tiny little Lego block, but it's a Lego block with its own engine and ability to communicate. So it could just assemble into whatever you want to. In practice, you might have it assembled in something that looked like an apple, but probably would not be an apple because you probably would never get anything that was down at the atomic scale. I think cellular level, but maybe smaller than a virus. Small cells, not, you know, atoms.
Yoda What says, Isaac Arthur, the Nyctopan soft weapon from Larry Niven's Ringworld universe is my favorite little bit of sci-fi technology. Among its charms is the ability to project beams that rip matter apart.
Niven comes up a lot of really good stuff. I mean, the Ringworld is always going to be my favorite there, but he had a lot of ones. We had the, I don't know if he was the first one to come up with the idea, but he had the monomolecular whip concept where you had one little sword that's like one tiny atom's worth across. And that would be so sharp it could cut through anything. Monofilament while. They also had the standard hulls, the general hulls. Basically, they could absorb an infinite amount of damage for one instant, and they would pause you in time so you didn't take any damage. That was a great way to have a spacecraft hull that was realistic in how it could absorb damage. So basically, wow, you're freezing in time while it takes the damage. Niven was, well, I shouldn't say was, I believe he's still alive. You know, he's just a fascinating source of information for so many ideas. I was actually, one of the scripts I just wrote, Topopolis Eternal River, that one is something that he first suggested too. So,
very good. Well, Timothy Kuiper would like to know, if it is generally accepted that gravity causes time dilation, and there seems to be an alternating theory that the time dilation is actually causing gravity. He wants to know what your thought is on this debate.
You know, that's one of those ones where you can probably argue that is the other way around. Like, we're saying, is the universe expanding or is everything inside it contracting? And I say, well, you know, it could be either one of those. You wouldn't have any way of telling if you were in a situation like that. I'm not sure I'd say that's the case with time and gravity per se, but I would stick to treating it as gravity causes time to slow down. You know, space and time contract around it. So you could probably make the argument that it was the other way around, that experiencing time is what allowed that, but the issue we have is that gravity and time are both weird little anomalies. They both only seem to be one direction, whereas most of the things in nature can go, you know, you forward or back, as it were, very easily. We don't necessarily want to assume that they are super interconnected, though. That's kind of like with the unified forces thing. We found that electromagnetism and electricity were the same thing, or electric force were the same thing. And we had electromagnetism, and we said, oh, wait, that's the same as the weak nuclear force, too. Well, we combined that one, and then we found we could connect it to the strong force. And so the assumption is, well, we must be able to connect all of these together to include gravity, too. And perhaps we may be able to sometimes, but wishing something to be the case doesn't necessarily make it so. I think sometimes we end up chasing grand unified theories a little bit too enthusiastically. You know, you gotta, let's see what the evidence says is the actual case, not try to assume it's the case and build towards it. Tempting though it is.
Escala says, I think that there are unknown forces in this universe that are so outrageously, unimaginably complicated that we humans just simply can't conceive it.
There's a good chance of that. Yeah, I mean, it's, to some degree, you expect stuff to be simple, although I say, well, I can't remember, maybe it was Einstein. There's a lot of things attributed to him that aren't actually things he said too, though. Say, it's something you can tell if it's right as a theory, if it's incredibly, you know, simplistic when you want to see it. The answer turns out to be really straightforward, as personally really insanely complicated, like retrograde planetary cycles was, you know, before they just decided to switch from over to the Copernican approach to planetary models. I said, well, yeah, that could be it. We could say that, you know, something's right in science if it's simple rather than complex. Only problem is that's letting poetry govern how you want to approach these things. There's nothing simple about how, you know, volatile molecules work. That we've tried modeling these. The basic thing about them is very simple. They're running on these electrostatic forces, but how those actually work out, emergent properties of systems, tends to be very complicated. Sometimes they have very simple rules they obey, like chess is an emergent property of human psychology, which is very complicated, and the physical laws of the universe, which are pretty simple in some ways. It has nothing to do with either of those, but it is an emergent property of them. So we don't always want to assume that everything in the universe is going to be very simple, and that's how we know it's right. Some of the stuff may be insanely complicated. You know, people would tend to assume that pi must have some, we don't think these days, but you know, some set number of digits or be some perfect ratio because that would make it more beautiful. And, you know, beauty is truth and truth is beauty. And I can't recall off the top of my head who said that. I should be able to, but I don't see a lot of indication that that statement is actually true. But, you know, might be more beautifully so.
Galen says, "There, you have an episode on colonizing the sun. Have you given any thought to an episode on colonizing hot Jupiters?"
You know, I have, though I should probably point out that no one has ever dared me to do that one. I guess we did kind of do one on making Jupiter a second sun. That was probably the hot Jupiter episode to some degree, too. Cythonian planets, which did not do well in the poll, would have been, Cythonian planets, would have been the probably the hot Jupiter episode. But for anyone who was wondering, colonizing the sun was one of the occasions somebody made a bet at me as to whether I could make an episode, and I decided I was going to make that episode. I said, could you actually colonize a star? The other one was the search and rescue episode. We did a high-tech search and rescue. Somebody had bet me if I could find a way to come up with a way to use a nuclear device legitimately, to use a nuclear bomb in a search and rescue exercise to help find, you know, to help save somebody. And I didn't find a way. I found four of them. I love that episode. So I always like to find an excuse to use nuclear bombs to solve problems.
And what episode was that again?
High-tech search and rescue.
High-tech search and rescue. Christian Carello, thank you for your super chat. Do antimatter rockets have to be thin and long, as often depicted, or is there some design flexibility if we invent better antimatter production and storage?
I mean, the main reason to make any ship thin and long that's for interstellar purposes is to cut down on the amount of stuff you're hitting as you go through space. Generally speaking, you know, we would say the ideal minimum width, minimum radius for a spin gravity environment is about 250 meters radius, because at that point, was that diagonal? Yeah, I'll check it when you said this, but that radius is what you feel comfortable at, less than two rotations per minute. It doesn't cause nausea any more than turning a chair maybe twice a minute or turning around the kitchen when making nauseous. So that's kind of your minimum diameter. You don't necessarily really want to go much above that if you can avoid that, because the wider you get, the more stuff you're going to plow through at you know, a high fraction of speed of light. And that's the usual reason why we depict these things as being very long and narrow. And then we usually tend to treat them as cylinders or cones, because there's no real assumption that, like a Navy ship, they really need a prow on them, as you've seen something like Warhammer 40,000, where the ships all look like old ships of line or cathedrals going through space. It's very artistic, but not really very, you're not really very logical way to build a ship, per se. For the purpose of the engine, it doesn't make any difference at all. I think with antimatter, the biggest thing would be wanting to have a nozzle of whatever material you're using to reflect gamma rays or what was going out the back of the thing. That was letting you kind of focus the beam a little bit, so you weren't wasting too much off the sides. So that's the biggest thing, is you ideally want your rockets, you know, propellant to come out the back in a straight line right behind you. And the more spread out it is, the more it's sending off some of that force to either side of you, rather than helping to propel you along. So you want to minimize that as tightly as you can.
Clash says, we often talk about building large rotating habitats in orbit, but how exactly would you actually get the materials needed to build them up there into orbit, whether from the Earth or the Moon or elsewhere?
You know, a lot of it depends on how good we get at launching things. Like, if you have an orbital ring already up in space, then you probably do all your low orbit materials right from Earth itself, because Earth has so much of it. You know, the asteroid belt is a tiny fraction of the total mass the Moon has, and the Moon's mass is 1/80 of what Earth has. So you're always going to get more off of Earth than you are all these asteroids and moons. On the other hand, you have to pay way less actual fuel cost to move stuff from the Moon to Earth. But, you know, I guess it would be the example of it might be cheaper to get something off of Antarctica in terms of how much fuel it takes to cut it out of there, but if you had to transport that whole way and you're having actually there to walk, you have to pay 10 times as much to actually employ someone in those locations, it might kind of start cutting that ability to have that as a cheaper option. So with something like an orbital ring where you're not really paying anything other than maintenance to get stuff up into space, you mine stuff from down on Earth. Without something like that, and we'd say an earlier era of space development, you're probably getting off the moon or a near-Earth asteroid, just because that's, as strange as it sounds, getting something 100 miles up in the air is harder than moving at a million miles across empty space. And so your question comes down to, can I actually dig out and mine and refine and build stuff, especially, you know, dumb matter like a big metal plate off the moon or an asteroid easier that can shove it up through the Earth's atmosphere? And that's one of those things where we just don't really know until we have a chance to actually start doing it on a more industrial scale.
D. Cragen says, hi all from the UK. Who else is from a time zone where they have rearranged the New Year's Eve plans somewhat in order to watch this last live stream live?
Statistically, about half our, well, not quite half, something like 40% of our audience lives in the UK, over east to about Russia, you know, somewhere in Western Europe or Eastern Europe. And then most of the remainder lives in North America with a lot of folks over in Australia and elsewhere. But our folks in Japan, I'm trying to remember the timeline, if the dateline is, which side of the dateline Japan's on. I think they already had their New Year. So for anyone who's over there, Happy New Year already. I think Iraq was 8 hours ahead when I was there. So Happy New Year to everyone in Baghdad, or very shortly there afterwards, everyone in Delhi, Happy New Year. So.
Raven, could robots take on lifelike characteristics like cells and respiration?
Very much so. I think that the thing to keep in mind is that when we're talking about robots, like back in the day when Asimov was playing around the concept, he used the term CFE or carbon iron FE life forms to kind of indicate that a robot was an iron-based life form and we were carbon-based. Well, now we have semiconductors and we say they were silicon-based life forms. But you know, whether or not you're built out of titanium or, you know, a robot made out of titanium or carbon or whatever it is, a robot